You're listening to the Paranormal UK Radio Network, the best in paranormal talk radio in the UK and around the world.
Paranormal Dimensions is fortnightly on Mondays on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Now tell me, my dear, what seems to be bothering you?
I don't know, Doctor. I'm always so frightened.
Frightened of what, Grace?
I'm just afraid.
You mustn't be afraid, not of anything.
This is Sasha Christie, and you're listening to the Paranormal UK Radio Network, the UK's biggest paranormal network. And this is Paranormal Dimensions with David Young.
Well, my dear, you look radiant. If I were Rembrandt, I'd paint a portrait of you.
Hello, and welcome to the show. Rembrandt, eh? First of all, I'd just like to say thank you very much for all the happy birthday wishes. I'm quite overwhelmed, actually. So thank you very much if you sent me a happy birthday message. Or is it a reminder? It's another year down the line. I'm not sure. But anyway, thank you very much. I really do appreciate it. But at least it's another year before the next one. So that's one thing, isn't it? Anyway, right. This show's guest is Katie Ray. Now, Katie is what I would call an expert on fairies and things like goblins and elves and all that kind of stuff. She's also a very big expert on mushrooms. So whether we'll get into the mushroom aspect of magic and stuff like that, I don't know. But I'm looking forward to this one because fairies is something quite new to me. I've not really been involved very much with or reading too much about fairies. But as I found out from Kate some time ago when I heard her talk, fairies are not quite what I would call nice in a lot of cases. They're actually quite evil. We might find out a bit about that. We'll see where we go with that one. But here we go with Kate Ray. Hello, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. I'm super chuffed to be here.
Well, I'm super chuffed to have you on. I was saying to you before, you've made me quite fascinated with the fact of fairies and goblins and things like that. I've always said to you that I found that type of thing hard to accept and believe in. And, it's kind of fairy tales, if you like.
Yeah.
You know? When you gave a talk a few months back, I was absolutely fascinated and I was blown away by it. And I'm sort of really eager to hear a lot more.
Oh, that's good. That is good, because I think that's one of my intentions is I set out on this journey to sort of change the landscape, really, of people's understanding of what fairies are. And we have a very sort of mono view of what fairies are, especially in England. It's not so much in Scotland and Ireland, but in England, they are very, very twee and sweet and very, very childish. And it's not where the history of the fairies lay, and it's not my experience of them either.
Because they're not all like the Walt Disney type, are they? Like flitting about with little wands and whatnot, and little wings.
It would be absolutely lovely if they were all like that. But no, actually, I'm saying that it wouldn't. It's a really diverse sort of rainbow of species, really, that people do forget, because it would, you know, the Victorians popularized the little winged beings. Before that, you know, fairies didn't have wings. That, you know, they flew on the backs of birds or you know, tailgated on butterflies, but they didn't necessarily have wings themselves, even if they could fly.
I mean, quite intrigued. How did you actually get involved in the fairyland in the first place?
It's a tricky one, that. I think the whole concept of fairies was something that was there precursor to a lot of the other paranormal things to me. As a child, I didn't buy into very much the sort of picture book type fairies. You know, there was the classic The Flower Fairies series that came out, and I did find them quite odd because that wasn't my perception of what they were. But that kind of feeling that there were these other beings in the landscape had always been with me, and never went away, really. I started connecting with a lot of people who had very similar views to me, particularly in my early 20s, bizarrely enough. And it was nice to find a tribe of people where you could discuss fairies on a sort of bigger, more adult level. And then came the paranormal stuff, you know, hand in hand with that sort of late teens, early 20s. But I'd had an experience that I'll talk to you about a little bit later on, that when I was 15, which really sort of compounded everything for me.
Well, right. I thought you were going to go straight into it. Sorry.
Do you want me to? I can.
Yeah,
do.
Absolutely. Like... Please. Yeah. I mean, I'm quite intrigued. So you've actually experienced fairies yourself firsthand, have you?
I have. It's not. I mean, a lot of people who experience the fae do so when they're young. You know, children are very. Even now, I was with my niece today, and she's. You know, fairies are just part of her world and her language. You know, she doesn't know that I'm talk about the fairies. But she was quite happily talking to me about elves and gnomes and whatnot. That didn't happen to me as a child. I had very few paranormal experiences, and I think partly to do with the fact that I shut myself down, because a lot of it was quite frightening as a concept. When I was 15, I had one of very few physical encounters where something manifested in front of me that was very solid and very real. And I had gone out on a bit of a crazy goose chase one Friday night. A group of friends, I was the youngest, a group of friends, we were sat around, very, very bored, nothing to do. And we decided that we're going to take this book from the bookshelf, which was called The Magical Atlas of Britain, and just flick through it, see if we could find a place to go. And it fell on a page, and somebody randomly ran the finger down the page, and it landed on the Uffington Horse, which is in Oxfordshire. So we found ourselves that night driving from Nottinghamshire to Oxfordshire. It was, you know, a couple of hours' drive. And then we didn't have a plan really from there. So we slept in a farm, on a farm track, in the back of the car. It was the summertime, so it was nice and warm. Got a few hours kip. We were woken up early hours of the morning by a slightly disgruntled farmer because we were blocking his track off. So we asked him, you know, where's the Uffington Horse? Because we turned up in the dark, we had no idea where the chalk horse was. And he pointed us in the direction. And as it was, we were actually going up the back side of the Uffington Horse. So as you come in, it's a slight valley. As you come in around the front, you can see the chalk horse quite clearly from the road. But we came up from the back side. And it was summertime, but there was a heavy mist that had formed in the morning. It was a very warm morning. And it was just as the sun was coming up, and it was pea soup. You know, you couldn't see more than a metre or so in front of you. And we were sort of shouting to each other, trying to find where the horse was. And as at that moment, when we kind of reached the summit, the pea soup parted, and there was a pocket of clear that just parted. And we realised in the same instance that we're actually stood on the head of the chalk horse. Wow. But at that particular moment, there was a herd of deer that hadn't heard us or seen us or smelt us. And it was one of those, it was just such a magical start to the morning that these deer were just up there grazing, and they bolted into the mist. So we took a little bit of time just absorbing the sun coming up and the mist moving and being on top of the chalk horse. Now, if anybody's been to the Uffington Horse, there is an ancient burial site, a Neolithic burial site. I think it's Neolithic. I'll probably get that one wrong, which is probably, I don't know, roughly, it's under a mile away. And we decided to walk down to it to have a look at that burial chamber. And it's a quite a deep path that goes down to, it's called Wayland Smithy. It's a fantastic place. And for people walking down that path, because it's chalk, it's been worn away quite, and it's quite steep on the sides. And the sides, as you're going down to Wayland Smithy, are sort of mounded with sort of hedgerowy type plants and shrubbery. And then it goes up into the hedgerows, which are at times their shoulder height, you know, before you get to the bottom of the hedge. So it feels like you're walking down a little bit of a tunnel. And my friends were striding up ahead. I was sort of hanging back. I was still, if I'm honest, I was very tired and I was a little bit grumpy because I was overly tired. And I kept hearing this. It was almost like a singing, whistling, humming all at the same time. And it was from multiple things that this noise was coming from. And the only way I've ever been able to describe it is it sounded like the clangers. You know, it sounded that like that whistling communication, if you like, between beings. And I would stop at my walking, stopping my tracks to try and point where it was coming from. And when I stopped, the whistling, the humming, the sound of it stopped. And then I would walk on a little bit and it would start again. And it sounded like in the hundreds. It didn't sound, you know, like one or two. I couldn't have mistook it as one or two birds. It was a lot of noise and it was coming from the hedgerow bottoms. So I tried a couple of times to dive on the foliage at the bottom of the hedgerow to see if I could see whatever it was that was down in that hedgerow bottom. And I could see the flash of things scuttling away, but I didn't actually see anything really visible to put pinpoint what it was. And on probably about the third attempt of doing that, I dove in, rugby tackled the grass and parted it. And my hands were either side of this this being. And I mean, I've actually done a sketch of it recently of what I saw. It was perhaps the size of your hand. The body was the size of a large fist. And it had a toad-like shape to its body. And its feet and hands were spread out. And it was on all fours, but it turned to look over its shoulder at me. And its head, it was very mousy in its features. So it had quite a pointed nose, but it was very humanoid mousy. And it had a downy fur to its head and that went down its back. But what really shocked me as I was looking at this creature and I couldn't fathom what it was it had a pair of tweed trousers on. And I remember saying out loud, or I think I said it out loud, it's got tweed trousers on. And that moment kind of broke the spell and it had this utter look of fear on its face. It squealed, I squealed, and then it shot off into the undergrowth. Now, at this point, I'm a bit kind of, what have I just seen? It looked very animal. It didn't look like a little human. It looked like a bit of a mashup of animals, but it was very humanoid in how it interacted with me and how it looked at me. It was very aware of me. So I trotted up to catch up with my friends and the first thing I said to them was, have you heard the singing? Have you heard the singing coming from the hedgerows? To which they hadn't heard anything. And then I proceeded to tell them about the tale of this thing that I'd seen. And at the time, the only word that I could associate was it was a gnome because it was very earthy looking. Well, the ridicule that I got, I didn't live it down for the rest of the day. You know, it was jokes and jibes from the guys. And because I was a teenager and I was sensitive to those kind of things, I didn't tell anybody for 10 years. It was 10 years before I actually told another living soul about what I'd experienced. And it was received, you know, it was received with curiosity. But it wasn't until I got to a stage in my life where I just thought, I don't care what people think. I know what I encountered. And I know that it wasn't anything that I could explain in the natural world. And that was a blessing. So that for me was going from being a child and kind of understanding that there might be these things within, you know, within another dimension, or, you know, hidden in our world. And then as a teenager at 15, having that sort of confirmed to me, I do see now as a blessing.
So, I mean, did you ever get to the bottom of what it was you saw, or was it, puzzled you?
It still puzzles me. I mean, I do interview other people about their experiences and talk a lot to people about their fairy experiences. And that particular, what I'd call a species, is something that that I haven't really come across in that way. Now, there are several theories about why that may be. There are theories that these things will manifest in a way that we can understand them. So it could be that, you know, I would have understood it more because it looked like two animals. And that was, at that time, I'm a big Brian Froud fan, and his artwork is very much, for me, that is fairy. And if anybody's come across his artwork, they'll understand what I mean. So it is that kind of animistic mashup of humanoid and bits of animal. Now, that thing might have manifested itself in that way so that I could understand it as a fairy, because I did instantly recognize it as that. It could be that they manifest themselves in a way that is to do with their surroundings, almost like a chameleon, because it very much blended in with its surroundings, its coloration. So that might be another way of looking at it. Or it could be that that was just a specific species to that area that nobody has really encountered, or nobody's come forward and said that they've encountered that particular looking thing.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. So I mean, do you class gnomes, elves and goblins all as fairies?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I think for me, the word fairy, and when I spell fairy now, I spell it in the old sense, F-A-E-R-Y.
Yeah.
Because fairy means, it doesn't mean a winged creature. Fairy actually means the other. And this is where it starts fitting in with the paranormal. So there is a whole spectrum of different, if you like, species, as broad, I would say, if not broader than the animal kingdom, in what people encounter. And I mean, that there is theories at the minute which are really exciting about things like, you know, does the Mothman fit into the fairy realm? Does the Yeti and the Sasquatch fit in? You know, aliens, there is a massive crossover with alien abduction and fairy folklore. There's very similarities between classic grey aliens with their big eyes and, you know, diminutive bodies that are very much classic fairy features. So there's lots of different crossovers. It's just unfortunate that we've got this idea of fairy as something that, you know, is very Peter Pan, that's very Disney-esque, because it's such a broad subject.
So I think what you're saying is a lot of these are like interdimensional creatures, and we would perceive them as maybe alien when in fact they're not. They're actually interdimensional.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I do like the whole interest in theories. I don't know personally where I'm at with it just yet. I don't think I need convincing or not, but I love it as a theory, that the fact that there is lots of correlations between the different races of alien beings and historic fairy folklore, and definitely how they look. I mean, I'm not a ufologist, and I'm not that up with my aliens, but if you think about something like the Palladians, who are very tall, very beautiful, and they're very elf like, you know, in that very traditional sense. It's, you know, is it our interpretation and our understanding, because we are limited in our understanding and interpretation, that it's just more within our consciousness now because we live in technology, that we then view the fairies as alien beings because they fit in with our view of the world right now. You know, it's a theory that I find fascinating.
Yeah. Or could it be that the aliens are being mistaken as fairies?
It could, yeah.
The other way around.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing is, as you know, with all the things that are paranormal, we can only hypothesize. Even when we get evidential stuff, it's not something that I don't think we're any closer to understanding on any better degree than we were 100 years ago. But for me, that's what makes it so exciting, that, you know, it's something that gives us wonder to the world and something that adds a different dimension. It means that there's something out there that's other than us. And, you know, and what that means is to us as human beings, it gives us magic.
Mm. So that was your first piece of evidence, really, because you know, something you couldn't explain. Have you had any sort of further evidence that's made you wonder what it was?
Yeah, I've had a couple more encounters. One was incredibly brief. Again, personal encounters. I was on my own. I was born and bred in Nottinghamshire, and Sherwood Forest was not far from where I grew up. It was in the village, so it was within walking distance. So I know the woods very well. And I moved away for a while, but I'd gone back home and I was walking my dog in Sherwood Forest. Now, when you know a woodland very well, you get different senses in different spaces within that woodland. So there are some places in Sherwood Forest that I find very benign, some places I find very peaceful, some places that I find, you know, have a really lovely atmosphere. There are other places that feel quite daunting and like you're being watched. Mm. And other people have, you know, corroborated with that that sentiment as well. But one of the places that I never really got a feeling for and would pass through quite quickly was just by the Major Oak. And it's always throng with tourists. So I kind of get out of there as quickly as I can because I kind of get overloaded with people around. But there was a particular day, and it was, I think it was at the start of summer, so it was late spring. It was a dull day. And I was walking up the path going away from the Major Oak. And my dog was up ahead. She was just sort of snuffling around. And I turned to my left-hand side. Something had caught my eye, and it was something not sparkling, it was kind of pulsing. There was a pulse at the corner of my eye, periphery vision. And I turned to look at this thing. Now, I'm just about of a certain age where I remember the old TVs where when you switch them on, you get static. And you'd get that kind of flash of static on the screen, turning it on and off. And it kind of went in and came out again, didn't it?
Yeah. When you sit there for 5 minutes waiting for it to come on.
Yeah, for it to warm up. Yeah, I actually got a slight electrocution that burnt my finger on one when I was a kid because I touched the screen because I was watching this thing. It was going very, very slowly, the static, so I stupidly touched it. So this thing in the woods, it was on my eye line. So it was, you know, a good sort of nearly 5 foot off the ground. And it just looked like that, but for a very brief few seconds, which is interesting. It looked like an upright dragonfly, but it was pure light. It was pure bright light. And it didn't have wings so much that it was emitting an energy that kind of formed a winged shape around it. And I didn't get any features whether it was humanoid or not. And then as quickly as it had come in, like that, the old TVs, it almost sucked back out of this reality. It was like, I suppose, like how you imagine a mini portal opening, and it was just that brief second. And I remember stood there thinking, that's a fairy, you know, and it was just very, very brief, and I wasn't shocked by it, but I was a bit bemused, you know. It was the busiest part of the woodland. There were other areas in that forest where I thought, if I'm ever going to encounter anything, it will be in the denser, you know, less trodden paths. But yeah, that was a very interesting encounter.
Mm, when you mentioned a fairy, a friend, I don't know if you've heard of a fellow named Bill Rook, have you?
I haven't, no.
He's had several photos he takes of light beings and things like that. But he took a photo which looked like very much like a fairy that you're describing.
Nice.
I'll have to try and nab the photo off of him, and I'll send it to you if I can find it, if you'll let me have it.
I would absolutely love to see that.
It was actually outside of a church. He was actually filming a church.
Wow.
And, he's always seeing these light beings and everything. And but this actual thing that he saw was actually like what you're describing, like a fairy.
Oh, that would be brilliant to see that. I'm always interested in people's experiences.
Yeah. But he's been writing a book for the last few years now. I think I don't know if the book will ever get out, but all these photos are supposed to be going into it. So,
oh, brilliant!
I'll see if I can nab it off of him and send it to you.
Yeah, that would be awesome. That'd be brilliant.
Well, I'm quite intrigued about, you mentioned, I know it's kind of not really paranormal, but the Robin Hood legend. Since you grew up in Nottinghamshire, Robin Hood legend is very big, isn't it?
It is, and it was always one of those things as a kid. We did take Robin Hood for granted, I think, you know, living in the woods. And I was always under the impression growing up that it was, you know, it was part myth, part, you know, mashed up with the whole Green Man mythology. And, you know, there was probably a character who became legendary for helping out the poor, that, you know, I think it was a whole mix of things. But I think one of the things that still does annoy me a little bit is the Major Oak. So, I mean, the Major Oak would have been absolutely tiny in the time of Robin Hood. It wouldn't have been the massive grandioso tree that it is today. Mm. I love the fact that Sherwood Forest has got that association with a legend. But the other thing is, and I only found this out sort of 10, 15 years ago, that the Major Oak was only called the Major Oak. I think it was in the late 1800s. Somebody will correct me on this. But it was always referred to as the Queen Oak. So it's a female oak, and it had this beautiful name, the Queen Oak. And it is a superb example of an ancient oak tree. And somebody with the surname Major, I don't know the story in depth, came along, decided he'd discovered it and slapped his name on it. Right. as far as I know, you know.
As people do, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how true that story is. But I do know that she was called the Queen Oak before then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Robin Hood's kind of got into the mythology legend, and it makes it kind of paranormal, doesn't it?
Mm.
A little bit like King Arthur and everything like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that was because there is that association with the Green Man and, you know, the wild men of the woods. There is a, you know, that element of him. And I think that goes back to, you know, the ancient deities like Pan and Canoonosh. You know, he had those qualities about him, living in the woods and doing good for good people, and, you know, a little bit cheeky, and always on the on back foot in authority, which I liked about him.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some other stories that he wasn't actually quite as nice as he was made out.
Yeah, and, I can imagine,
and he was probably quite nasty too. You know, but but yeah, I mean, there's all various stories. I'll tell you what intrigues me is the Cottingley fairies. I mean, what's your opinion of those? Do you think that was a fraud?
I do, and I don't think that is particularly the crux of the matter. So I remember as a child watching, and I can never remember the girl's name. I think it's, was it Elsa? And I can never remember.
Yeah,
Cottingley is one of those things that I almost dismiss, and I shouldn't, because I think I dismiss it because it became so twee when it shouldn't have been. But one of the ladies who was still alive, I think it was in the 1980s, came on TV and said, you know, before I die, I want everybody to know that the pictures were a hoax. But she did say, however, the last one wasn't. Now, the interesting thing about the Cottingley fairies is not the fact that these children hoaxed these, because they were cut out of a magazine, a child magazine or a child's book, and they would pin them up so they looked like they were in situ. it's not the fact that they hoaxed some really interesting characters, Arthur Conan Doyle and Harry Houdini, I think, was involved in the case as well, that they took the world by storm. For me, the interesting thing is they always, always said they did it because they were seeing these things, playing with these things and interacting regularly with the fairies. And they wanted the rest of the world to believe them. And I think that that is really at the heart of that story, that these girls were so driven to tell the world about these beautiful beings that they were interacting with, that they were so desperate to do that, that they came up with a hoax that fooled the world for many, many years, decades, you know, fooled the world. But it made people believe, and people went out looking for fairies. And it was in conjunction, hand in hand, with the rise of spiritualism at the time. So people like Conan Doyle bought into it hook, line and sinker, and loved, you know, the story of it. And I'm sure it's inspired a huge raft of people over the generations to look into what the fairy folk are.
I actually think, being little girls like they were, they were actually quite clever to pull that off, actually, when you think about it, you know, back then, because it was actually quite clever.
It was incredibly clever. And I think it was that ultimately their belief that they were having these interactions that helped them pull that off. I think if there were children just hoaxing, because they weren't, you know, they were clever girls, and they weren't mean or bad hearted. So they didn't want to fool the world just to fool the world as trickery. They genuinely wanted people to believe that the fairies existed, because they understood that the fairies did exist. And I think that that belief kept them going in trying to get other people around them, especially adults, to believe in them. Now, unfortunately, I went to last May, I took a trip up to Yorkshire, and I went to where the girls had interacted with the fairies, and I was deeply disappointed. It felt very off. They built a housing estate, literally, where a lot of the photos were taken. You can still get down to the stream, which is lovely. It's still lovely, but you have to kind of almost, you don't trespass, but you almost feel like you're scrabbling down, trespassing through this housing estate. And it just felt like, you know, that there's this incredibly historical, magical place, and it's not accessible. You know, it's not accessible for people to go and spend time there and to try and understand what these girls were going through.
Yeah, it's a shame when you find these buildings go all over the place and just take everything away, don't they?
They do.
You mentioned the word portals earlier on. Now, I'm actually quite a big believer in the fact that there's portals all over the place. Have you had any experience of that yourself, apart from that one you mentioned?
I personally do believe that they can pop up. You know, it's a complicated thing, you know, whether it's the energy of people coming together that open up portals, whether it's people using magic to open up portals. I am a massive believer in earth energies creating portals. So where you've got ancient standing stones, burial chambers, Neolithic monuments and sites, I think that people, our ancient ancestors, understood those energies of the earth and actually tapped into that by placing these sacred sites on those spaces. And it kind of correlates with the fact that the church would often build their churches on sites of pagan worship. And it wasn't necessarily just to squish the paganism out. It was also, they understood the power in that landscape, you know, and what came from it. I've had discussions recently with different people, and the idea, it's a resonancy of quartz within the earth is one theory of how that happens, that there are certain frequencies that the earth gives off at certain places that open up portals, you know, that where we can bring in ancestors, or, you know, converse with the fairies, or the fairies can come in and out of those portals, or, you know, it's not necessarily portals are a negative thing. I mean, we often associate portals with, you know, demonic activity, where, you know, somebody's used a Ouija board, it's created a sigil, they've opened up a portal, you know, and they get infestated with an infestation of negative energies. But they can be incredibly powerful and enriching and healing, as well as a negative experience.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things, like you didn't sort of mention, you mentioned churches and that, but not ley lines. I mean, ley lines seem to point to a lot of these portals, I believe, as well.
They do, and I deliberately left it out. I'll tell you why. Yeah, I'll tell you why, and I joke about this. I look such like a hippie that I stop myself from saying really hippie things because I don't want to look any more of a hippie than I actually look like.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with being a hippie, is there?
No, there's not. But I think I've tuned myself into saying things like earth energies instead of using the word ley lines. Right. It's like the whole word fairy, isn't it, that people have this aversion to the word fairy. When people hear the word ley line, they just go, oh, you know, it's New Age bunkum.
But it isn't, though, is it, as you know?
It's not. It's absolutely not. But I think in changing our terminology, we can start having conversations where people are a little more inclined to listen. Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, when you sort of mentioned churches, I thought, you know, people might. Oh, yeah, well, that's got to be serious, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll see where you're coming from. There's another sort of a link that I think about a lot when I think about the fairies, which I know little about. The magic of toads. Toads seem to be very, very magical.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, I mean, there are lots of spirit animals that are associated with the fairies. The fairies are intrinsically linked with the natural world. And it's interesting that you mentioned toads, because there's also the Flyer Garrick toadstool. And, we know from different cultures that toads can have hallucinogenic properties to them. And, I mean, that's maybe one aspect from it, because people do report on psychedelic experiencing fairies all around the world. I think toads as well, because they are, when you have animals that go into hibernation and suspended animation throughout the winter, and then they look, all intents and purposes, that they're dead, so they go over to the other side throughout that period, and then they are transported back into the life in spring, that they represent traversing the two worlds, if you like. And they bury themselves underground as well, which is that that kind of symbolism of the other side, whether that be death or whether that be another dimension. So definitely toads is a good one. I haven't had a lot of time to think about toads in conjunction with fairies.
No, I was thinking about witches as well. You seem to get the toads linked with the witches as well, don't you?
And
whether witches come into the area of fairies, I don't know.
Oh, definitely. There is a massive link. So where we get the word elementals, and where we get the gnomes, the sylphs, the undines and the salamanders, which are the four elements and the four elemental fairies of earth, water, fire and air. So they all correlate with those. That actually came from an alchemist, Paracelsus. I'm rubbish with dates. You'll have to go up and have a look at the dates. But that's where that terminology comes from. And very much in witchcraft, when you are working with the elements, it's always good to call up a being or a spirit from the element. And these creatures, whether they were created out of an investment by magic or whether they actually existed before, is a good debate. But witches would call upon these things. And in terms of toads, yes, they would have them as familiars, but witches would work very, very closely with fairies. Now, that could come from a number of reasons. That could come from they understand that fairies are intrinsically linked with the elements and intrinsically linked with nature. Or it could be, you know, slightly on the side, it could be that one of the theories is that fairies come from lesser deities. So there was a time in human history where you know, even things like your fire hearth would have its own god or goddess to keep that fire going. So these were seen as lesser deities. You'd have your big deities, you know, your kind of big pagan deities, but then you would have, you know, a lesser deity that would look after your sheep, or that would look after the wildlife within a woodland that was near you. And that's one of the theories, that actually fairies come from these ideas of lesser deities that we've lost the folklore on and lost the real link with. I quite like that theory. Again, it doesn't give us the whole picture, but I quite like that as one of the theories.
Is that a thing about toads? I was always told that if you touch toads, you can get warts. Is that true?
I don't know.
whether you know that, or was that just one of these old wives' tales?
I think so. Yeah, I think probably so. I've heard that one before as well. I don't know. And I think the whole thing about toads being associated with witches, you know, witches were always portrayed as, you know, very old, gnarly women with warts over the faces that probably were described as having skin like toad's skin. Yeah. You know, that
probably where it came from. Yeah.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, possibly. And I know that going on to the witchcraft thing, witches, they wouldn't have called themselves witches, they'd have been wise women or herbalists, but definitely the ones who dealt with herbal remedies would often use names for herbs that were a little bit secretive. So when you hear that bubble bubble, toil and trouble, and eye of the newt, and you know, tongue of the frog, or whatever they were chucking in the pot, they are often references to common herbs, and they wanted to keep that knowledge to themselves about making medicines for people. So they would often give them these very odd names. So they weren't actually boiling up, you know, puppy dog tails and things like that in a broth. It was actually herbs that they were going out and collecting.
Yeah, I found that quite sad, really, because those ladies were actually just normal ladies, weren't they? But they were called evil by the people that wanted to control everything.
Yeah,
today, really.
Yeah, definitely. I think what it is when singular people hold power that a community looks up to. So they would have been midwives, they would have been herbalists, they would have been counsellors, you know, they would have been people who people went to for advice or for guidance, as well as being very spiritual people that could commune with ancestors. Now, that is a very powerful holding to have within a community. And when you have organised religion coming in, those kind of people are a threat, because whatever they say to a community is very much taken with respect. And if you're trying to shift over a pagan community into Christianity, then those people can be difficult, you know. And I think that it's a very complex complex thing when we look at the witch trials. But I think that that's probably one element of it, that they were such revered and powerful people that they needed to be displaced at the very least. And we know from history, you know, that very innocent men and women were strung up for witchcraft.
Hung, drawn and quartered and burnt and everything, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I also know very much about you. You're an expert on mushrooms.
Oh, that's a difficult one. You know, if you say you're an expert on mushrooms, everybody wants to go out and I get millions of pictures saying, what's this? And I think I haven't got a blinking clue.
Oh, right.
I'm an amateur forager, and mushrooms are definitely a passion of mine and a love of mine. And I think that that's linked in with the fairy factor and with the paranormal factor as well. There are so many species of mushrooms that we haven't even touched a very, very small percentage of finding them and identifying them. It's our biggest living organism on the planet. You know, people think when you say that, people go, oh, it's a whale. And it's not. It's the mycelia from mushroom can go miles and miles and miles, radiating out and radiating down. And it has got associations with the dead and ancestral and spirits of the dead for all kinds of reasons. But I do love my mushrooms, definitely.
I know, that's why I had to bring it up. I mean, you design jewellery and ornaments and all sorts of things, don't you?
I do. It kind of took over. I was in a previous incarnation in this life. I was an art teacher. And so art and craft is definitely something that I pursue often. And I never, ever set out to just build mushrooms, but I would do other things and it would be like, no, you've got to put a mushroom on it. And then I would just go back to churning out hundreds of different mushrooms in jewellery and homeware. And it did take over.
They are I find mushrooms are a little bit, they are kind of magical, aren't they? That's what I find. I know we're on a paranormal show here, but I think there's quite a lot of links to the paranormal with mushrooms.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is. I mean, just on the fact that, like the toads, they traverse the world, because you have the mycelia, which is it's not a root actually. It's a sentient thing. They're neither plant nor animal. They sit in their own world, and they're not really very easily classified. Mm. But because the mycelia, they actually work. They hunt underground, and then you have these fruiting bodies that pop up. Now, we know more about mushrooms, I think, than ever before, in terms of scientific research, not as in colloquial knowledge, because we would have had that knowledge anyway, but we know things like mushrooms have a huge, just your normal mushrooms that you buy from the supermarket have a huge amount of vitamin D in them. And they do say that if you put your mushrooms in the sunshine, that triples. So before you eat them, if you put them in the sunshine, they will just absorb the vitamin D out the sunshine. And that's on the lighter end of the scale. We know that things like there's a lot of research into a common mushroom called turkey tail, which is a bracket mushroom that has anti-cancer properties, and people have been successfully treated with turkey tail mushroom. Now, where it comes into the paranormal is definitely its links with shamanism and shamanic practice. So you have something like the classic fly agaric, which is the red and white mushroom, which is my particular attraction, as a mushroom. It's the ones you see on Christmas cards, the ones that Santa's elves are usually sat on. Now, that has, if it's respected and prepared properly, it has been used for shamanic practice. I'm not advising anybody to go out and do that, because it has got a label of toxicity to it, and a high toxicity to it. But people, shamans, European shamans, would use that to journey, if you like, to the ancestral land. So they would ingest it and they would bring back messages. So they would meet beings and bring back messages from those beings. And it was often either the dead or it was fairy. They would meet elves, particularly on those journeys that they would have on this psychedelic.
I suppose it's a bit like an LSD trip, is it?
Yeah.
Not that I've ever done it, I must point out.
I think mushrooms are very, very different in the fact that they can be very unpredictable. And when you're dealing with raw natural plants that do induce these kind of these trips, you never know what the quantities are, and because you know people haven't got the testing ability to be able to look at how much they have in them. But things like the fly agaric mushroom, you can get a mushroom that looks absolutely perfect. You know, it's the perfect, letterbox red. It sits beautifully. It's nice and plump. And then you get something that looks a bit old and a bit sort of falling over, and you don't know which has the higher property in it. There's no real indication, if you like, about which one will induce more within you than the other. So, yeah, you have to be careful on that.
Yeah, are most of the mushrooms you see, maybe in woodlands and forests, are they all kind of harmless, or can they be quite dangerous?
There are some killers out there. So there's, there are. The, yeah, there's, yeah.
That's why I would never go out picking any and say, well, this would be nice for dinner, you know, because I wouldn't know what I was looking at.
I mean, there are quite a lot of mushrooms and fungus out there that it's there's nothing really like them out there, and they're very easy to identify and absolutely delicious eating. And there is a lot of them that even if they're if you ingest the lookalikes, because they do have ones that look alike, it will make you queasy. You know, you'll have a bad tummy for a few hours. There are a handful of mushrooms out there that are deadly poisonous. Destroyer angel is one of them, and as you can imagine from its namesake, and that looks very benign. You know, it looks like a beautiful white mushroom, and it's quite an enchanting mushroom to look at, but incredibly deadly, to the point where I get a bit freaked out even if I touch one of them, and I'm like, you know, must wash my hands after it. You know, after I touch it, it's not that toxic that if you touch one, then you know you're not going to get affected by it. But in terms of toxicity, you know, I would do your research, but I recently came across some research about the fly agaric that said that for it to induce anything that would be incredibly dangerous and harmful to the body, you would have to have 25 kilograms of fresh mushrooms. Right. Now, if you ate 25 kilograms of potatoes in one sitting, you'd expect to be poorly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the deaths are there are, I think there's one death recorded in the 1900s that was attributed to the red and white mushroom, and nobody could actually say that it definitely was that.
Yeah.
I'm not encouraging people at all to go out and be irresponsible. Yeah. But there are lovely ones. I could talk about mushrooms all day. You see, it's a passion. But things like chicken of the woods, which is a big chunky blousy orange and yellow bracket that is absolutely delicious, and it's very very distinct, and there's very few things out there that even look anything like it, and it is gorgeous eating. It's really, really good eating.
Really? If I come across any mushrooms, I'm going to send you a picture saying,
I'm going to get inundated. And the thing is, when people do that, it's always I'm not very good at what I call the beige ones, which are the beige and the browns and the kind of little oranges, you know, the spindly ones. I know the very distinct ones. There's an absolutely gorgeous tiny little mushroom that loves to live under hazel trees. It's called the bird's nest mushroom. And it's probably about the size of a pencil top, maybe a little bit bigger if you're lucky. And it looks like a brown basket that's full of the sweetest little bird eggs that are iridescent. And that it's just so magical when you find them. You know, it's all my life I've been trampling around the woods, and you know, it's only in the last probably 5 years that I've started furtling through the undergrowth and going, that is just amazing.
Anyway, anyone listening to this out there, I think the best advice is get your mushrooms from Tesco's or Sainsbury's. I think that's probably the safest option.
Yes.
You know, Do like I do.
Yeah, go out and find them and admire them. The fairies do like that, by the way. They like people admiring the natural world. So go out and find them, photograph them definitely, because they're astounding. And maybe find a local forager who'll take you out if you want to go and sample some delight.
I know. They grow incredibly quickly, don't they? They can grow sort of overnight.
They can, some of them are stunning. I mean, giant puffballs particularly are amazing. They're sort of large football size. You know, they're not little things. And when you come across those, I feel like I'm in the set of Willy Wonka, because they're just unbelievable.
But I know your jewellery and your designs and things. I'm going to have to steal a few photos and put on the Paranormal Dimensions page so people can see you. And also, I guess they can order jewellery and stuff from you, can they?
Yeah, directly from me. I'm just literally in negotiations to go over to an up-and-coming sort of pagan market online. So I will be selling online. I have tried unsuccessfully to set up my own website, but I am not great technically, so...
But anyway, I'll put some links on there. People can at least see your photos and pictures and things.
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
Right, now help, my house is haunted. I happen to know that you're good friends with Barry Guy and Jane Harris and Ian and
yeah.
Have you got psychic abilities of your own?
Psychic, yes. I think I will say this till the day is long. We all have. It's whether we
I agree with that. Yeah.
But to what
extent, isn't it?
Exactly. It's whether some people are born with, you know, with that skill in place. Other people have to work on it. Other people choose to shut it down. But yeah, I think for me, I would never say that I'm a medium. I don't really genuinely have conversations with the dead, although I do pick up on their energy and I can get some kind of mental images, if you like, from those situations. But it was never really where I was comfortable in doing that. The psychic does very much go into the fairy realm, which surprised me, especially when I was I had a few years where I was really knee deep in practicing a lot of different spiritual elements, and it was the fairies who kind of popped up for me. And I do, from that period of time, see myself as somebody who's now an ambassador for that realm in trying to convey to people what they're about and what they're not about. But yes, I do know Barry very well. Barry is a very good friend of mine. He's also my lead investigator and part of his team, which is Go to Find a Paranormal Society. And I've been in that team, I think it's coming up 5 years this year. So I do see Barry on a regular basis. I've met Jane a couple of times. Jane is so sweet. She is such a down-to-earth lovely lady. Haven't met Ian yet. I do speak to Chris Fleming irregularly because he is very much on board with fairies being part of the paranormal world.
Yeah, because he was in the first two seasons, wasn't he?
And
I think when the lockdowns and everything came on, I think he was kind of stuck in the States and he couldn't really do the rest, I think. I think that's what happened, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So he couldn't get permit to come over, and I think even now it's quite difficult from the States, and it the increase in expense and whatever, that unfortunately he hasn't been able to sort of come over and do that. I know he came over and did, was it Spooked Scotland with Gail Porter?
That's correct.
So,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I know he did. So he's got some other things going on. Yeah.
Yeah, which is nice. And I know that I spoke to him, I think it was the first episode of that where he had come across. He was very excited, actually. He'd come across Scottish fairies while he was filming, and he was overwhelmed, I think, by the clarity of communication that he got with them. So he was very excited.
He was, yeah. I think I saw that first episode.
Yeah,
I haven't seen the rest, unfortunately, yet. But I mean, do you actually go on paranormal investigations yourself?
I do, yes. So I'm at the Hellfire Caves this weekend down in Buckinghamshire. That's a sold out event. I mean, the majority of the work that we do is events based, which is it's fascinating. It's great because as you know, as part of the team, we get access to some amazing locations, as you know, and you're able to have free reign, if you like, going around these locations before you have your paying public guests come. Mm. And I say that, and I hate saying public guests because, you know, they become team. You know, we have regular people turning up, and it is like investigating with a team. We have a lovely following of people. Occasionally, we do private cases, and that's really where my passion lays. I really like investigating private cases because of the complexities of them and because of also being able to assist and help individuals and families out in those situations. It's a tricky situation, though. We do get requests to do that. However, there are lots of ethics, and we are a very ethical team in how we choose what private investigations to assist with, because there are, you know, it's a massive amount of responsibility when you go out and do that, when you're working with people, especially people who are vulnerable just from the paranormal experiences that, you know, they're very vulnerable. So you have to be very mindful when you do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what sort of instruments do you use, if any? Do you just use your body?
I personally, technology and me don't get on well. At all.
You told me that.
I know. We're not the greatest of friends. It tends to do very funny things when I'm around. And for me, the technology that I do use when I'm out and about is it's nice to get extra verification. I'm quite old school. I will use things like dowsing rods, pendulums, spirit boards, just doing the very, very old-fashioned Victorian seance where you're calling out and you're asking for DVPs or manifestations to come forward. In my mind, a lot of the time when we have objects that are flashing and beeping, they're a distraction. So it could be when a piece of equipment's going off that it actually turns your gaze away from something that may be happening somewhere else in the room. If you are in tune with a room and you are quiet and you understand the ambience of the place and space that you're in, I think you're more likely to have a paranormal experience. This is just my opinion. I leave the tech stuff to Barry and to the guys because they love it and they get some fantastic results from it. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Barry genuinely is the EVP king. You know, the stuff that he gets is second to none. He has such a connection with electro voice phenomena and getting results back on that. Whereas me, I'm not that confident with that piece of kit. So I tend not to use it so much. The ones that I do love, I love the SP7. I love my SP7. I love white noise and working with frequency, definitely. And recently using the Alice box. So that's another one that I like. Although I do find even those a little distracting. I do like to do things a little bit quirky. So I'll often do, if I'm with a group that I know well, I will often do different experimentation. Deep meditation is one of the things that I will experiment with. The other one that I'll do is I'll look at very, very old-fashioned ways of, you know, getting objects to move in a sealed jar, for instance, and see if we can get communication in that way. So, yeah, I'm pretty old school is what that's the roundabout way of saying it.
I know you mentioned spirit balls. You actually mean the Ouija boards and stuff like that?
Yes.
Because, I mean, some people don't like to use them, do they?
They don't. And I can completely understand why. And I always say to the people I'm around when I suggest that as a form of experimentation that for me it's absolutely no different to any other form of communication. You're asking out questions, but instead of a voice being recorded on a tape recorder, a voice recorder, you are getting that communication through a board. However, there is a caveat, and it's one that I keep a close eye on. When spirits are using spirit board, like all forms of communication, you get a lot of trickster come through. So a lot of trickery come through from the spirit side. And it can get very confusing and it can get quite frightening sometimes. So I'll shut down at that point. The other caveat, which is a big, big, big one for me, is that spirit will use a spirit board to draw sigils, so draw symbols. Now, these symbols can be used to empower them or can be used to open up portals. So when on a spirit board, and it's very, very, very common that this happens, when the planchette moves in a certain pattern frequently, so it will go in a very specific pattern, and there are different patterns that they use. That's them drawing out a magical symbol. And it tends to get faster and faster and faster, and that's building up that energy. That's when people start encountering problems because it is giving that entity energy and it's also allowing for magical portals to be open. That's my perception of it.
Yeah, I've experienced that actually when it starts really powerful, you know, powerful movements.
Yeah, and it's undeniable, isn't it, when it happens? Absolutely undeniable. So at that point, I do say to people, I pre-warn them about that and say, if we get a repetition, a two-time repetition of moving and it's not making sense, it's not spelling a word, even if it is spelling a word, But if there's a repetition twice, one after another, then we're shutting down the board, we're coming off, and we're disconnecting from that energy, because that's where things get dangerous. But it's, I mean, it's all, any communication with spirit is can be a dangerous thing. I'm not going to lie about that. It's not, you know, we're not always spiritually safe when we're in this game.
Do you believe there's the demonic entities on the other side that interfere with us?
I don't like to use the term demonic. I'm not a religious person myself, so for me, the word demonic has actually been, it's been twisted. But I understand what you're saying. I do believe that there are incredibly malevolent energies, incredibly deep, dark, ancient malevolent energies within the world, just as I believe that there are very light, very good malevolent energies on the opposite end of the spectrum. I do believe that there are those ends of the spectrum. However, I don't think that those extremes interact with our existence as much as we think they do. I think for me, when we get things that come through that have demonic characteristics or behaviours, they're often the lesser end of the kind of fairies. They are the malevolent, mischievous end of the fae, if you like, so that range of the other. And yeah. I think that demonics and angelics kind of fit into that realm as well. They're the extremes. So when we get people who are suffering with night terrors, you know, they're being pinched, they're waking up with scratches, all those kind of things, to me, without other things added to it, would suggest to me that they are being visited by, you know, for want of a better word, and I'm not keen on the word, but for want of a better word, an imp.
What?
Or something with impish behaviour. Now, when you're getting into demonic or that kind of behaviour, you're talking, you know, oppression and possession. You're talking things like levitation. You're talking deep illness. You're talking, the experience is very, very different and very, very intense, where people become scared by impish behaviour. It kind of feeds into that. So they will experience it regularly, I think, you know. But yeah, I do believe in that extreme energy, definitely.
Yeah, with imps, it kind of takes us full circle back to the fairy lands again, doesn't it?
It does, definitely. Yeah, it does. I know that was a term that Chris Fleming used quite a lot on Help My House is Haunted. And it's actually not, an imp is... It's kind of almost like another word for a malevolent pixie. It's more of a behaviour than it is a being. And I can understand why he used that word quite a lot, and why the fairies mirrored that back to him and said, you know, we are imps, or when he had those communications, because it does explain their character and their behaviour. They're not there to grant you three wishes or take your tooth from you under your pillow and leave you a pound coin underneath, you know. But they can be worked with, which is an incredibly important thing to stress here, that they are not unreasonable. Even the most impish, if you like, and the most mischievous and the darker end of the scale, they're not unreasonable. And a lot of the time they want to have recognition, and they want to have the right kind of recognition and interaction with humans. So they're not like, you know, when you hear people talk about exorcism and how difficult it is to exorcise those demonic entities, those really dark, malevolent energies, where there's no reasoning with them. It's literally the power of prayer and the power of light that gets rid of them. With the fairies, it's not that hard of work. It's not that level of difficulty. A lot of the time, they just want to talk. You know, they just want to tell you who they are, why they're there, and they're a little bit like really naughty kids. Just want a bit of attention.
Have you ever experienced any? You talk about demonic entities. They seem to use that term a lot in the American shows I've found. Like everything's sort of demons.
Yeah. I have found that as well, and I think it's part sensationalism, and I think the other part of it is there's the whole concept that you stare into the abyss and the abyss stares back at you.
Mm.
So when you go out trying to find these things, they're going to find you. So I think it's a mix of that. I think it's a mix of sensationalism, but in with that sensationalism, these things are actually being drawn forward.
Yeah, I can see that. Have you experienced any poltergeist activity yourself?
poltergeist activity. Before I became, I've always researched the paranormal, but before I actually became a ghost hunter and working on the shop floor, as if it were, poltergeist activity was my biggest fear. It absolutely terrified me. Mm. I lived in an incredibly haunted house. And I was in denial about it for a very long time. Other people were experiencing things. I lived there on my own, but I'd have friends over, family over, and they were experiencing things. And it very much started to manifest, as I know now, into an oppressive energy. Now, I'm not saying it was demonic, but there were elements of it that had that kind of classic, really very dark, malevolent energy to it. But it did manifest in light poltergeist activity. You know, it wasn't stacking of chairs on your kitchen table kind of thing, but it was, one of the most frightening things that happened to me in that house, which sounds ridiculous now, was I'd just gone to bed one night, and I'd been hearing for several nights a scraping noise. I'd got neighbours who'd recently moved in next door, and I just equated it in my head that they were decorating at stupid hours of the night, you know. So I was rationalising everything all the time. And it was a scraping that sounded very metallic, like on a wall. And I'd actually experienced it a couple of nights previous to that night. I'd experienced that sound on my front door, which was onto a pathway. So again, I rationalized it that somebody had brushed past it or somebody was playing a trick. And I'd just gone to bed, hadn't even turned out the light. I'd put my head on the pillow, and the scraping noise came from inside my bedroom. And it had shifted, and it was very loud. And I lifted my head off the pillow and was listening, trying to locate it with my ears. And as I turned, at the bottom of my bed were my two cats. I had two cats at the time, who were at the bottom of my bed, foot of my bed, with their back arched, looking in the corner of the room. And there was a wardrobe. And in between the wardrobe and the wall, I had crammed a massive old-fashioned army rucksack. It was kind of, you know, you just sort of cram it away. And it was very wedged, but this thing was lifting and scraping the side of the wardrobe and the wall as it was being dragged up in the space. And it was going up in sort of sequences of three drags, sort of three pulls, and then it would stop and the bag would drop. I mean, this is how much of not a paranormal investigator I was at that time. This was my cure to the situation. I picked up a pillar and threw it in the direction of whatever was happening. I was absolutely convinced that this pillar was going to get rid of this evil energy.
Yeah, we'll frighten the laugh out of it.
So it done that for, you know, it was lifting it up and down for quite a while before I plucked up enough courage to throw the pillar. And once I threw the pillar, I waited for a good period of time, which felt like an eternity, to see whether it would occur again, and it didn't. So I leapt out of bed, and I took the rucksack and I threw it down the stairs, and I did not sleep for days after that. And things kind of started making sense to me where I tried to rationalize them. So, for instance, I'd had an incident where my stepsister had come round to the house, and she was sat in the front room, and it looked directly into the kitchen, and she went pale. She was sat on the sofa that she could see directly into the kitchen. She went pale and she said, "Have you got water in your sink?" And I said, "No, why?" And she said, "I've just seen the a sponge being lifted up out of your sink and it's now spinning around." Now, in my mind, because I was so incredibly frightened, I said, "Oh, don't be silly, seeing things." And she is a completely rational person, you know, not into the paranormal at all. And she left, and I don't think she ever visited the house afterwards. I also had a time not long after I was dating, and my boyfriend at the time had come over. He was washing his face in the bathroom sink, and he actually had his head pushed into the bowl of water. And he thought it was me mucking around. And again, he was not into the paranormal, didn't believe in any of that kind of thing. And it kind of escalated into smells and sounds and that kind of thing, and light sort of poltergeisty type activity.
Ooh, scary stuff.
It was horrible.
It sounded horrible. Well, I don't know what that's kind of blew me away, that is. Anyway, have you got any events coming up? Are you going to be going to any conventions and things later on the year?
Yes, so I'm back at the Parameet. It's turning into a crazy weekend that weekend. I was looking forward to it being a really relaxed weekend of being able to, you know, set up my little stall and talk to people and have my talk and just really relax. But I've been invited to another conference on the Sunday, which is about earth mysteries, which I've been asked to go and talk about fairies and their link with the earth mysteries. And I'm going there with my co-host to my YouTube channel, Dr. Neil Rushton. We're going together and giving a talk there. So I'm doing the Fairy Festival in Glastonbury in a couple of weeks. So I go and stand stall there. I'm being asked to talk there about the links between the paranormal and the fairies. That's just actually come off today, which is brilliant. I've got a few irons in the fire, which a few exciting projects, which I don't really want to speak out into the ether just yet because I don't want to jinx them. But I will totally tell you when those.
Oh, please do. Yeah, I'm hoping I'll bump into you again at some point.
Yes, I'm sure we will. I'm sure we will.
Parameet. When is that? Is that in September?
It's September. Yeah, I think it's later on in September. Oh, no, it might be earlier. I don't know. It's September, but that's all.
There's a Festival of the Unexplained is in September. I don't know if you'll be going to that, but that's at where I saw you, at Bosworth Hall.
It is. Yeah, I did Karen's event a couple of times, and I think it clashed. I found Parameet an incredibly warm and welcoming affair. It was very, very relaxed.
Yeah, that was Neil Pecker's one. You were talking
about.
Yes,
it is. Yeah,
very good. Yeah.
Yeah, it was lovely. I felt very relaxed, and I was eavesdropping on other people's conversations quite impolitely, and everybody was so enthusiastic, and they were there for the paranormal, and they were there to discuss, which blew me away. Everybody was there to discuss different theories, different ideas, different bits of technology. You know, it felt like a real powerhouse of people exploring different things.
Mm, it was very well attended and taken as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I know people were very eager about it, and I think I think it's going to be a yearly thing now by the sound of it.
It better be. I loved it.
I'm hoping I'll see you there anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure we will.
Anyway, Kate, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for finding the time to come on. I know we've got to give it away, haven't we? We did have a go the other night, but everything went wrong. My laptop went up the wall, and I was playing around with it for about 4 hours, and Kate said that was probably my fault.
Yeah. I genuinely have this effect on technology.
But anyway, we've got it done, so that's good. It seems to have come out all right, I hope.
Yeah.
But it's been fantastic talking to you, Kate. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm still very, very my intrigue into fairies is growing daily. I shall be getting some books and things, and I'll never be the expert that you are, but there you go.
I don't think anybody can be the expert on these things. These things are there You know, we're finding things out all the time, and anybody who says they're an expert is deluded.
Yeah, it's as I said before, it was one of those things I just thought was, well, as I said, fairy tales. But yes. And I couldn't see. I'd like Charles Terry fairy tales, but there's an awful lot more in it, and I see it's a lot more malevolent sides of it as well.
Yeah, things to be respected. Definitely.
Well, anyway, I'll let you go, Kate. Thank you very much for coming on. It's been fantastic talking to you.
It's been a blessing.
I shall watch out for you in the future, and please stay in touch.
Will do. Yeah, thank you so much for having me along, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
I'll thank you very much for coming on. It's my pleasure.
Pleasure. Right,
Kate, thank you. Take care of yourself.
Welcome.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There we are. That was Kate Ray. Amazing. Thank you, Kate. That was brilliant. Okay, now the next show I've got is another special for you. I seem to be doing them weekly now for some reason, but there's going to be a break after the next couple. But the next show is going to be quite an epic one with Jim Peniston and Gary Osborne, both at once. And they'll be talking about the Rendlesham Enigma and the book they wrote together. I've had Jim on separately and I've had Gary on separately, but now we're both on together. And Gary's going to be explaining, hopefully, a bit about where he is now with the binary code. I'm really looking forward to that one. An extra special with Jim Peniston and Gary Osborne. And that will be on Monday, the 6th of March. Now, as always, if you'd like to get in touch with me between now and then, my email address is davidyoung2qn@yahoo.co.uk. That's davidyoung2qn@yahoo.co.uk. So until then, March the 6th, Jim Peniston, Gary Osborne, which I hope you'll join me for. This is David Young signing out, and I will speak to you then. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night. Sleep tight. Pleasant dreams.
Spooky, huh?
Paranormal Dimensions is fortnightly on Mondays on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.